The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, and 24/7 support. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer code Guardian to get 10% off.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Claire Armistead.
Christmas is almost upon us. The bookshops are crammed with gift editions. Jeff Kinney's Wimpy Kid is slugging it out with football giant Alex Ferguson in the charts. And the great and the good have delivered their verdicts on the books of the year. So what are the books that have impressed us this year? Podcast stalwarts Richard Lee and Lindsay Irving have been mulling over the highlights of their literary years. And they join me now. Lindsay, let's start with fiction. You're with Roddy Doyle and Mohsin Hamid and being a bit of a George Saunders fanboy, aren't you? His collection, The 10th of December.
Absolutely. I mean, he is something of a marvel. And 10th of December continues the magic with this extraordinary trick he pulls off of combining biting satire of contemporary American corporate culture with really touching human stories. And satire that moves is a very rare feat.
When we were discussing this, we thought that it might even have been published last year because it was a first footer. It was published on January the 3rd. But we mustn't forget those books, must we, from early on in the year. They tend to get overlooked.
Absolutely not.
Now, Richard, you have one from early on in the year, not quite as early as that, but from March, don't you?
Yeah, the springtime appearance for Kate Atkinson with Life After Life, which we should not forget as well. I mean, the vagaries of the publishing year mean that they drop off the radar very quickly. It's a great thick novel of what-ifs about a personal identity, about history, and about kind of the what-ifs of fiction itself. Can you actually move people with a story that keeps jumping back and forwards in time? Can you actually get people to believe in a character who keeps living her life again and again? And the answer, I think, is yes. I mean, it's a terrific achievement.
It's also been a year for big books, hasn't it? The Kate Atkinson is quite big, but nothing like as big as Eleanor Catton's The Luminaries, which actually I really enjoyed, although I have a sneaking admission, which is my absolute runaway favourite on the Booker shortlist, was Harvest by Jim Crace. But you've got another big one, haven't you, Richard?
Yes, absolutely. It's Sergio de la Parva's A Naked Singularity. He published it himself in 2008, having completed the novel and sent it out again and again and again to agent after agent. And it's an ambitious book. Again, it's about perfection. It's about philosophy. Be about physics. It's full of all these kind of fizzing ideas, but powered by this amazing voice. It's the voice of Kazi, who's this New York public defense attorney who just speaks at ninth a dozen, rattles it off all the way through this story. And nobody would touch it. So he put it out himself in 2008. And then finally, after there was a kind of gradual buzz developed, finally the University of Chicago Press picked it up. He's won prizes and he's got, you know, another book just out, reviewed by Edward Docks very positively just the other day.
Which is tiny.
Very much so. He's one of those writers, you just never know what he's going to come up with next. He's a very exciting voice, I think. A terrific, terrific guy.
Okay, from someone who's completely new to someone who is old, at least to us, which is, and isn't even a someone, Lindsay, we're talking about Wu Ming, who came to the Guardian's attention as Luther Blissett back in the day. They have come with their new novel, Altai.
He, or rather they, have pulled off another fascinating counterfactual history, looking into or exploring the outcome of the Battle of Lepanto, which is 1570-something, and imagining that emerging out of that is a proto-Zion in Cyprus, of all places. That's quite a feat in itself, as is the thought of five different people somehow together creating a bit of sustained imaginative fiction.
Richard, you are very keen, I know, on Exodus, which has one of the more daunting subtitles of the year. I have to say, it's Immigration and Multiculturalism in the 21st Century. Now, don't tell me that you're going to be stuffing this into your children's stocking.
No, not so. I mean, but if you say what are the books of the year, then you need to come up with some books that are important. And I think this is an important book.
Who's
right
it
here.
By?
It's a guy called Paul Collier. Who argues in the book that migration is not only kind of big, but also accelerating in the 21st century. And there are various economic forces, he says, are driving it to get faster and faster. And he thinks this is potentially very dangerous for Western society, mostly because he thinks Western society's prosperity is founded on this chance, how institutions and societal norms, which mean we trust each other rather a lot, so we can rely on someone to pay a bill or to deliver your shopping or whatever. And he thinks those norms are under threat from large numbers of people coming into the country from places where those norms don't apply. There was a leader in the newspaper just the other day calling for some clarity in this debate, calling for something to fill what they call the dangerous silence between kind of people on either side. And Paul Collier he's a man who's got a way of doing it.
So if you're looking for something to fill the dangerous silences that can so easily develop over a family Christmas, this might well be your book. Lindsay, you're going down the hobbyist line, aren't you, with
aspect. Very ambitious history from Bob Stanley, which is a feat that nobody's managed before, which is a complete history of pop. Starting with the first pop charts at the beginning of the 50s and going to right at the end of sort of conventional pop records and CDs as we stand. A bit of sustained scholarship while also fizzing with infectious enthusiasm. So that will be a bit more sort of straightforward holiday entertainment, perhaps.
So, Richard, you've gone for something rather different for your second choice, haven't you? Which is the Julian Barnes's Levels of Life.
Yeah, it's under our kind of non-fiction section, as it were, but it's a little bit more complicated than that. It's a three-part study of grief, so not very many laughs around the Christmas tree with this one either. The first section is about some 19th century balloonists and focuses on a guy called Félix Tournachon, who was the first person to combine the technologies of photography and ballooning. And then there's a kind of novella, there's an imagined story, a love affair between two of his balloon pioneers, Fred Burnaby and Sarah Barnhart. A brief flight, which of course crashes when their love affair comes to an end. And then these two bits of groundwork, as it were, are brought to bear on the third section, which is an account of his own struggle for perspective after the loss of his wife. And it's a very moving book. It's a very reticent book in much ways. There's a lot he's not saying, but equally he's very straightforwardly addressing the way that he felt, his grief, and kind of what that does to it. I found it extraordinary.
There's something about balloons this year, isn't there? And one of my favourite books was Richard Holmes's Falling Upward, How We Took to the Air, which is full of the amazing stories of people taking to the air, including some meteorologists who flew to 32,000 feet in the 19th century. They don't actually know they did, because one of them was unconscious and the other one was trying desperately to get the balloon down to save their lives. They survived it. And they were recording the weather, but they were also recording the effect of extreme altitude on their fingers and their noses. So what the discoloration of their skin and what oxygen deprivation felt like is just really extraordinary.
There's also a lot of colour about kind of old technology, but maybe there's something kind of both interesting and comforting at the same time, because we're living through a period of immense change. So maybe it's kind of interesting to see how those guys back then dealt with similar kind of transformatory experiences, but also we can kind of laugh at them, you know, with their gloves up there at 32,000 feet, but surviving.
One of my favourite anecdotes was Benjamin Franklin patented a refrigerator tethered to a balloon, which lifted his food up into the cooler, higher reaches.
Are we to gather that Dreadnought is asking us all to do something dishonest? Richard asked. Dreadnought nodded, glad to have been understood so easily. Just as a means of making a sale, it seems the only way round my problem, if all present wouldn't mind agreeing not to mention my main leak, or rather, not to raise the question of my main leak unless direct inquiries are made. Do you, in point of fact, want us to say that Dreadnought doesn't leak? Asked Richard patiently. That would be putting it too strongly. All the meetings of the boat owners, by a movement as natural as the tides themselves, took place on Richard's converted ton-class minesweeper. Lord Jim, a felt reproof to amateurs, in speckless, always renewed grey paint, overshadowed the other craft and was nearly twice their tonnage. Just as Richard, in his decent dark blue blazer, dominated the meeting itself. And yet he by no means wanted this responsibility. Living on Battersea Reach, overlooked by some very good houses, and under the surveillance of the Port of London Authority, entailed, surely, a certain standard of conduct. Richard would be one of the last men on earth or water to want to impose it. Yet someone must. Duty is what no one else will do at the moment. Fortunately, he did not have to define duty. War service, in the RNVR, and his whole temperament before and since, had done that for him. Richard did not even want to preside. He would have been happier with a committee. But the owners, of whom several rented rather than owned their boats, were not of the substance from which committees are formed. Between Lord Jim, moored almost in the shadow of Battersea Reach, and the old wooden Thames barges, 200 yards upriver, and close to the rubbish disposal wharfs and the brewery, there was a great gulf fixed. The barge dwellers, creatures neither of firm land nor water, would have liked to have been more respectable than they were. They aspired towards the Chelsea shore where, in the early 1960s, many thousands lived with sensible occupations and adequate amounts of money. But a certain failure, distressing to themselves, to be like other people, caused them to sink back, with so much else that drifted or was washed up, into the mud moorings of the great tideway.
The book that's been most often cited in the Guardian Review's Book of the Year is that unfashionable thing, a literary biography. And not only a biography, but the story of a novelist who only had her first book published when she was over 60 years old. She was Penelope Fitzgerald. And I'm joined in the studio by her biographer, Hermione Lee, and one of its enthusiastic reviewers, Robert McCrum. Hermione, you've previously written biographies of Virginia Woolf and Elizabeth Bowen, among others. What made you so sure that Penelope Fitzgerald was up there with them and worthy of this huge biography?
I always start from the point of view of a passion for the work and also a desire that writing about the life might bring people back to the work or bring people closer to the work. So that's been my experience writing about people like Willa Cather or indeed Edith Wharton in this country. And although Penelope Fitzgerald has great admirers, and as the reception of this book has suggested, she has even more admirers than I realised, she has been in some ways neglected and undervalued. And I had the great good luck to have been her great admirer and then to have been approached by the family who asked me to write the book. And the minute they asked me, I knew that this was something I wanted to do and had to do.
Robert, I've described this as an old-fashioned biography. You loved it. Mm. Why do you recommend it so strongly?
One of the great things about the book is it's a portrait of Penelope Fitzgerald. And as you just said, Hermione, you come to her as a great admirer. I wonder, what was the book that made you fall in love with her?
Yes, I think I started reading her in the early 80s. So I think it was after she'd won the Booker Prize with Offshore, and then I caught up on the earlier books. And the strange thing about this is the first time I've written about someone that I knew. So I was sort of doing things like literary interviews and reviewing in the 80s, and I interviewed her more than once.
Do you think you knew? She's obviously
not
hard.
At all. I didn't know her at all well, and that was part of the lure, because when I looked back on the interviews that I'd done with her, and at the time I'd no idea I was going to be writing her biography, retrospectively I could see that she was fantastically evasive. And she used to lie to people, you know. I mean, so for instance, she wrote this novel called The Beginning of Spring, set in Russia just before the revolution, and people would say to her, "My goodness, you know, this is such an incredibly vivid and profound picture of Russia at that time. You must have lived in Russia for a very long time." And sometimes she would say to people, "Yes, I've lived there for many, many months." And sometimes she would say, "No, actually, I've never been there in my life." And the truth was, she'd been there for 1 week in 1975. So she liked to play games.
Mm.
She beat Naipaul to win the Booker with Offshore in 1979.
She did, and there was a sort of horrible reception, the sort of book programme to sink all book programmes, which was Robert Robinson being fantastically cross and irritable and patronising because he'd never heard of Penelope Fitzgerald, and he had assumed that Naipaul, who didn't even bother to show up, was going to be the winner. So there's this extraordinary programme, which I've watched, where he sort of pretty much ignores the winner and turns to everyone else and says, well, it's clear that the wrong book won.
And she said she would use the money to buy an iron and a typewriter.
Yes. She played a game of presenting herself in post-Booker years, especially in the 90s when she became more well-known, as a sort of slightly daffy old granny figure, completely unworldly and a little bit daffy. Nothing could have been further from the truth. This was a phenomenally razor-sharp and acute and on-the-ball person.
I'm interested that you talk about the early novels and the late novels, but the early novels were when she was in her 60s,
yes.
And the late novels were when she was in her 80s.
There is a problem about definitions with her, because there is a tendency to talk about the first novel she wrote when she was in her 60s as being her early novels. These are her more autobiographical novels, drawing on her own life. And then there are these four, I think, great masterpieces, Innocence, The Beginning of Spring, The Gate of Angels and The Blue Flower, which go away from her own experience, and she would explain why she did that. But of course, bring her own emotions and feelings and knowledge to bear. And one might want to call them historical novels, but they feel very different from something like War and Peace or Wolf Hall, which are the sort of things we think of as historical novels, because there's this extraordinary, as you said, Robert, there's this extraordinary feat of condensation going on, compression.
Speaking of condensation, this biography clocks in at over 500 pages.
Counting the index.
It's a big book.
Yes.
About quite a small subject.
Yes.
Did you ever worry about the length?
Yes, but it's a sort of two-in-one book. So I wanted to write about the work. I wanted to write about the books. I start as a literary critic, and, you know, I'm sort of a literary critic before I became a biographer, and I'm deeply interested in the work. So I thought, it seems to me relatively unlikely that there will be a lot of biographies of Penelope Fitzgerald, as there are a lot of biographies of Virginia Woolf, for instance, though who knows, there might be in the future. I thought I would do everything, and because I found such a lot of material in her archive about the way she worked on the books and the research she did for the books, I sort of went to town on writing about the novels. But then there's the story, which is rushing along, and I think the story goes quite briskly, and, you know, I mean, you say it's long, but people haven't said, oh gosh, it feels long to read. I feel that the story goes quite grippingly and fast, and people can not read the bits about the novel if they'd rather not.
Can
you know.
Tell us the story? I mean, for example, she won the Booker with a book about somebody living on a barge, and she lived on a barge, and it was absolutely disastrous in her life. It doesn't come out in the same way in the novel.
So very briefly, the story is, this is a person born just in the middle of the First World War into an Edwardian family of bishops and intellectuals, the Knox family, about whom she wrote. She was a very brilliant young girl and young woman. She was a brilliant scholar at Somerville. She was clearly going to be a writer. Then came the Second World War. She went to work for the BBC. She married...
And fell in love with someone who you don't identify.
We're not sure.
I think you know who he was.
I have a little go at it, but she kept her secret. She kept her secrets well.
That was clearly a very important moment in her life.
Yes.
The falling in love.
Yes, and there's a lot about lifelong unrequited love. So clearly something happened. And who knows, things may have happened at other times, but we just don't know, so you can't make it up. So she marries Desmond Fitzgerald, who's a very lovable and rather beautiful, and as it turns out, not successful person.
A drunk.
He went to war. He had an appalling war. He came back profoundly traumatised, used to wake up screaming every night. He became an alcoholic. He was a loving father. He failed in his professional life. And it was she who had to support the three children. And then came the period of... It's an extraordinary story of English class life, really, a sort of someone who could drop through the nets of the middle class, genteel English professional classes and become truly penurious. I mean, there wasn't enough to eat. So they lived in Suffolk. They lived on this barge, which sank. They lived in sheltered housing. They lived in a council estate in South London. She taught And gradually, all the writing that she had clearly wanted to do all her life began to come through. So it's only in her, at the turn of her 60s, when she starts to publish. She publishes 12 books in 20 years. She becomes famous at the age of 80 with the publication of The Blue Flower. And then there isn't another novel. And she dies at 83. So it's an extraordinarily inspiring and yet sad story.
Now, you say that a lot of her archive went down with the barge. Yes. Do you think that there were lots of stories that she'd been writing all those years that disappeared with the barge?
I don't know, because she never says. There is quite a lot of writing before she starts publishing. In fact, a great deal of writing before she starts publishing. And this idea that people have of her, that she didn't start writing till she was 60, is wrong. And there are stories, there are articles, there's journalism, there's BBC scripts.
And these are all in Texas, are they? Are they in Texas?
Mostly, yes. Mm-hmm. She sold a large part of her archive 12 years before her death to Texas. They didn't give her much for it. Yeah. But she did a tremendous weeding out, because she was this very secretive person. Mm. And so it's really hard to find anything personal.
One of the things that comes out of the book is you refer on a number of occasions to the fact that she's not really very English, despite her apparent Englishness, and that her real passions are European writers.
There has been a tendency to sort of park her alongside
Belle Bainbridge,
yeah. Barbara Pym, Stevie Smith, all of whom are fantastically interesting writers in their way. Some of them leave me cold, but that's another matter. But she's not really like that, and she knew she wasn't like that. Very interestingly, almost her favourite writer was Beckett. And when the Beckett novels came out in the 50s, Malone died and so on, she was on them. She was teaching them. Mm-hmm. She would teach him. There are pages of notes about Beckett in her manuscripts. Mm-hmm. She was deeply in love with Turgenev. Fathers and Sons was one of her favourite books. She liked things like Alain Fournier's Le Grand Monde. Mm-hmm. And I think that the kind of novella that she writes is in a way more of a European form than it is an English form. Though there are some wonderful
English novellas. Although you could turn to some of those books, some of the novellas, some of the early novels, and you'd say this is a highly condensed, highly abbreviated English novel. It doesn't feel very European, does it?
They're about England, the early novels. You know, a novel set on a barge on the Thames, or in a bookshop in late 1950s Suffolk, or in a theatre school in the early 60s in Covent Garden. I mean, those are very English situations, and they're full of very English characters, she's terribly good at people talking. But there's something about the form, and there's something also about this strange mixture, which is very, very hard to pinned down. I spent a lot of time feeling like I was walking all over it with big boots, you know, of tenderness and coolness, of a kind of a sort of distance, or seeing people through the eye of time and actually making you feel extremely close to and fond of them. And it's a very strange and interesting mixture.
If you were to choose one book to start with, if you hadn't read her, what would you choose?
I think I might choose her own favourite, The Beginning of Spring.
I was going to say that, yeah. Were you? It's a wonderful book.
Yes. It's the one set in Russia. Mm-hmm. It's a story about a usual sort of hopeless character who's her main character, who's a man who doesn't really know what he believes or what he wants. And his wife inexplicably has left him on the first page of the novel. And you spend the novel waiting to see whether she's going to come back. But all kinds of other things happen. And there's this sense of waiting, which, of course, is absolutely brilliant about the waiting that's going on, waiting for spring to come, waiting for Russia to change. So you have this big horizon and this little tender human story.
Very Jacobian, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Mm. But they're a lovely early one. I mean, Offshore itself is a wonderful book, the one about the barge.
It's been quite a year in children's books. We have a new children's laureate, Mallory Blackman, a new Asterix album, the first in 8 years, and we've even had the great Judith Carr on evening television. But how has it been for the people who actually read the books and possibly want to buy them for Christmas? With me in the studio are Julia Eccleshare, children's books editor of The Guardian, and Michelle Pawley, editor of The Guardian Children's Books website. Julia, you've got a huge array of beautifully colourful books in front of you, including, I see, Peck, Peck, Peck by Lucy Cousins, which has taken a leaf out of The Hungry Caterpillar's book, hasn't it, by having holes all the way through the book.
Yes, and I do think that whole format is a very attractive one. I took the view that if we're thinking about what might be good books for Christmas, as well as looking over the year, you have to think that all children are suspicious of that package that looks like a book. I mean, it's not a great starting point. So you've got to give them a book which is going to be immediately appealing. You don't want to give them a book that they're going to sort of put aside and then come to later. That can happen at other times of year. But I think on the day, it's got to be a book that looks like something that you're going to want to open at once. And I think Peck, 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 everybody loves those little holes in The Very Hungry Caterpillar. And this has exactly the same principle. From the cover onwards, you've got the woodpecker and he's pecking his way. And there's wonderful through things. There's a wonderful moment when he tries to peck a lavatory. I mean, lavatory is a good copy anyway, but the thought of a woodpecker and that porcelain is fun for adults too. So, yeah, Lucy Cousins is brilliantly creative, and the Maisie books are so well established in children's minds that I think they'd move very happily on to Peck, Peck, Peck. It would occupy a child very well on Christmas Day.
And it's robust, isn't it?
So very
it's not
solid,
going to, it's not
very
going to be
chunky.
Just for Christmas,
no,
it's
no,
for all time.
No, a very chunky book. Nice one to have on your shelf forever.
So, what are the books for the very young?
Well, this isn't quite so young. I think this is one of the most entertaining picture books I've seen for a long time. This is Oliver Jeffers, who is usually quite cool. His picture books are usually quite kind of cool and the characters are quite distant. This is The Day That the Crayons Quit. You will never open a packet of those nasty wax-covered crayons again with the same view, because in this, all the crayons have a say about how they're used by this boy, and they have very strong views. So the black says, you know, it's all very well, but why am I just used for outline? That's really dull. And then there's a very OCD purple who says, I don't mind being used, but you must keep me within the lines. Red says, I love being so popular, but couldn't I do things that aren't fire engines? And so it goes on. And it's just very, very funny. It's very creative, and it will encourage children to pick up the crayons and draw. Perhaps my favourite reissue of this season is the Russell Hoban, Quentin Blake, How Tom Beat Captain Najork and His Hired Sportsman, a book that came out in the 1970s and is actually about how all learning is founded on play. This is a message that we badly need.
Michelle, the centre of the children's website is the 8 to 12 age group, and you've got quite a few recommendations in this area, haven't you?
I think for Christmas it's really nice to give kids maybe the first book in a new series, partly because that makes future birthdays, Christmases a lot easier for you if they like it. It also gives them a good starting point into something. And there were a couple of new series out from well-established authors this year that I think kids in the 8 to 12 range who like adventure and excitement and, in the first case, a bit of dry humour will really go for. The first one is Lockwood & Co. by Jonathan Stroud, who we know from the Bartimaeus trilogy. And it's the adventures of a group of ghost hunters.
So what are the other series you'd recommend?
Well, Owen Colfer, who, of course, we know and love for Artemis Fowl, has a new series called Warp. The first one is The Reluctant Assassin, and it features a reluctant assassin, an underage FBI agent, and lots and lots of thrills and spills. And there's more to come with that series, so I think that should keep children occupied for quite some time.
Julia, how about you?
Well, I would go for Laura Dockrell, whose Darcy Burdock title is on the shortlist for the Royal Dahl Funny Prize. She is quite an amazing force, and this is the first in a series. It was going to be a three-book series, but the first one has been so successful, it's going to be a five-book series. Laura Dockrell is a completely astonishing writer. She's really a sort of stand-up performer, but her books manage to be an amalgam of Roald Dahl and Jacqueline Wilson, which sounds unlikely, but that is really the truth. So it's about the story of her life. I mean, she's a great believer that life provides story. So there is no moral message, there's no narrative arc of the normal kind, but there's a lot about family, there's a lot about imagination, there's a lot about creativity. Within it, there are sections in which the Darcy character writes her own book. So it's actually quite inspiring to children to become their own writers.
So now let's just bring you both to your top tip for this. If you were giving a present to a child this Christmas, what book would you give them?
I would like everybody to read How Tom Beat Captain Najork and His Hired Sportsman, because I think it's important. But I would also like any teenager to read the winner of this year's Guardian Children's Book Prize, which was Rebecca Stead's Liar and Spy, because I think it shows just how thoughtful, how discreet, but yet how powerful a story can be.
I'm going to cheat and recommend two for teens because I think they're linked. The first one is She's Not Invisible by Marcus Sedgwick, who we've mentioned a couple of times already in this podcast. It's about a teenage girl who happens to be blind. That's not the centre of the story. And she's off on a quest to find her father in America. Second one is Picture Me Gone by Meg Rossoff, which also features a teenage girl on a quest to discover somebody or to find somebody in America. And they're both written by authors who I think are at the top of their game at the moment.
"Nearly time," said Judy, glancing at the grandfather clock. It was 5 minutes to eight. A feral cat named Treacle arrived on the patio expecting to be fed. I wondered if the cat would scare off the badgers. When Judy rose and offered it a dish containing a morsel or two from the badger's feast, Treacle held out a paw as if it was saying thank you or craving the touch of a human hand. The cat disappeared again. A few minutes ticked by. It was still broad daylight outside. Suddenly, a badger. It thrust through the clotted cream-coloured elder blooms and bounced up the lawn like a little trotting horse. Judy slid the patio door ajar. "Come along," she quavered in her special high-pitched badger voice. "Come along then, I can see you." The badger stopped, looking towards us, ears thrust forward like miniature satellite dishes. "Here's one to take back," said Judy, throwing a sandwich. "You can find it." Like the incoming tide, unnoticed, four badgers arrived on the patio. These were the descendants of Dainty, Judy's first badger. Today's matriarch and the badger Judy knew best was called Willow. She was paler and browner than the others, with a broader stripe down her nose. This year's cubs were salt, pepper, mustard and vinegar, and they looked like surreal garden ornaments, pausing and raising their noses to the air. "Would you like a sausage?" Judy called out. "Willow, have a sausage." Willow stubbornly stayed 5 yards away, eating Judy's special badger mix with a wet noise, somewhere between the slobber of a dog and the tidy consumption of a cat. As bats took to the darkening sky, nine badgers congregated on the patio, merging and separating and rippling like grey waves. The nine bodies eddied and swam this way and that, as if they were connected, a toy train of animals. It did not seem a natural scene. Badgers may live in mixed-sex groups in Britain, but they tend to be solitary foragers unless there is a glut of food. Most farmers, of course, would hate this kind of husbandry, but many animal lovers disapproved of feeding badgers as well. What kind of dependency was being created? What would happen to the set when Judy was no longer here? Judy's banquet was one hugely influential type of human-badger relationship, however. Here was a deep bond between an isolated elderly lady and a family of badgers. And, like all things in Badgerland, it unfolded beyond the trundle of conventional life.
That was Patrick Barkham reading from Badgerlands, the Twilight World of Britain's Most Enigmatic Animal, which has just been chosen by the independent bookshops of the UK as one of their books, Overlooked Treasures, the books that we should be reading this Christmas, when in fact most people will be reading Alex Ferguson's memoirs. What is it about the badger that so appeals to you?
I think it is its enigmatic nature and the fact that we don't quite know what to make of it. And most people have a very clear idea about, say, the fox. They know it's an extremely cunning predator. But the badger, we don't really know. Is it good? Is it evil? Is it predator? Is it prey? And it's kind of existed almost hidden for centuries.
You put in quite a lot of your own stuff into it and you actually eat a bit of badger. What occurred to me is I wonder whether part of our ambivalence about the badger is because we've never really found a use for it. It isn't very good.
That's certainly true. It doesn't perform any function for us in the countryside, and even hunting it doesn't provide good quarry, because digging it out of a set is a back-breaking task ill-suited to a gentleman.
They don't run.
Yeah, and the reason I wanted to taste it, I wanted to test whether it was a taboo, whether we didn't eat badger because it was somehow like a songbird. There's a wonderful writer from the 19th century who writes, "A robin? I would sooner eat a child." We don't eat badger because basically, it tastes really quite disgusting because, like us, it's an omnivore, so it eats a huge variety of food, so it doesn't have a predictable flavour in the way that venison might, for example.
It's been described as tasting like swan poo.
Yeah.
But, however, there is a long history of identification with badgers, going right back to John Clare.
John Clare's poem really is the first and best piece of writing about the way we used to bait badgers, and a whole village gangs up on his badger. And indeed, some people think that it was how John Clare felt about himself, being sort of hounded out of village life, if you like, and not at home in the village and not at home in the city either. But he was also probably making a very literal point about the badger, which at that time in the 1830s when he was writing was baited in quite a horrific way by villagers pursuing it. It wasn't considered good sport by the aristocracy, so they left it alone, and so pursuing it was a sort of rough and ready pursuit carried out by farm workers and later by workers in industrial towns, a sort of peasant beast and a peasant hunt, if you like.
Coming into the 20th century, and we have the great badgers and the less great badgers of children's literature, yeah. Particularly Wind in the Willows, Kenneth Graham's badger, who you say revolutionised the way that badgers were regarded.
Graham's portrayal of Mr. Badger as a sort of heroic, authoritative leader of men. We forget that that was a very radical portrayal at the time, and the badger hadn't been portrayed in that way. Apart from John Clare's writing, there was almost no positive references to badgers anywhere in literature or in even in the letters pages of newspapers and so forth. The badger was considered vermin or just simply mysterious. There was something slightly witchy about it because it was an animal of the night. And you only have to see almost every fictional badger since follows the template set out by Graham. It's a slightly boring template, really. The badger's a curmudgeon, isn't he, and an authority figure. But there was a counterpoint to that, and that was Beatrix Potter, of course, and her portrayal of Tommy Brock in The Tale of Mr. Todd, which actually came out 4 years after The Wind in the Willows. But at the time, I mean, Potter was very much the superstar of children's literature, and her Tommy Brock is an evil, duplicitous, villainous creature who steals baby rabbits, lies to Peter Rabbit, and actually outwits the fox. So her badger's more cunning than the fox. And yet that portrayal didn't take hold at all in popular culture in any way. And I would suggest that in some ways that's because it wasn't actually true to the spirit of the species. And the badger isn't. Scientists agree the badger's not a very clever animal. It's not sly and clever in the way that the fox, a predatory animal, has to be. And therefore, somehow Graham's portrayal was more true. It's obviously Mr. Badger's a great work of fiction, but he's somehow true to the spirit of the species. He has an immaculate set. Badgers are very cleanly animals. They always spring clean. And so Mr. Badger was a very authentic, real, live badger.
Now the badger is once again the villain, through no fault of its own, because of tuberculosis. Where do you think we are with it now?
I think we're in a real muddle and a great stalemate, really, because we've had for 40 years now the badger's been implicated in bovine TB. And scientists do agree, there's a very clear scientific consensus that the badger does contribute to bovine TB in cattle. The main transmitter of bovine TB in cattle is other cows, but the badger plays a part. And therefore, culling badgers, if we were brutal enough with culling badgers, we would have an impact on the disease. But unfortunately, as a great nation of animal lovers, or maybe not unfortunately, we can't be brutal in our culling of badgers, and society's divided. And so you get the recent culls that were sabotaged in a very effective way by a small, relatively small, but very committed band of animal rights activists and animal lovers who have successfully made the current cull on its own terms. I'm speaking very neutrally here, but on the government's own terms, the current cull that's just concluded has been a disaster. They were testing the efficiency of culling badgers, and they needed to cull 70% of the badger population, and they've culled the government's changed the figures around to try and make things look more favourable to it, but at best it's culled just under 40% in one of the zones and 58% in another. So the government hasn't hit its own targets. So in that sense, once again, we're left with what do we do with the badger in our countryside? And we're hopelessly divided. And farmers are genuinely suffering, and a lot of farmers dislike the badger and do want to see it controlled, but they're not the sort of figures of great bloodlust that we maybe assume they are. And I'd hope that badger Lands puts forward their case fairly as well.
And that's all we have for this week. Thanks, Patrick, and thanks to Richard Lee, Hermione Lee, no relation, Robert McCrum, Julia Eccleshare, and Michelle Pawley. We've got some great stuff coming up over the next few weeks, so do keep coming back to us. You can subscribe via iTunes or SoundCloud, and do tell your friends to do so too. I'm Claire Armistead, and my producer is Tim Mabey. From both of us, goodbye.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag and drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today, no credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your new account by using the offer code Guardian.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.